KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
My uncle's wife, Dr. Ala Amin al-Najjar, she's a doctor for the children. She treats children, and in a moment, her daughters and her sons died. Yahya, Sidra, Luqman, Sadin, Rival, Jubran, all of them died.
A Palestinian pediatrician in Gaza is back at work just days after an Israeli airstrike killed 9 of her 10 children. Dr. Al-Najjar's husband and their 11-year-old son were seriously wounded. We'll go to Gaza and speak to a British surgeon who operated on the son.
What on earth can you say to a woman who has lost 9 out of 10 children, aged between 12 and 6 months, all in one bomb blast?
Then we look at President Trump's escalating war on Harvard University after a judge temporarily blocked Trump's move to ban Harvard from enrolling international students, who make up more than a quarter of the student body. Trump has threatened to cancel $3 billion in federal grants if Harvard doesn't hand over personal information about each of the students.
We want a list of those foreign students, and we'll find out whether or not they're okay. Many will be okay, I assume. And I assume with Harvard, many will be bad.
Plus, we go to Georgia, where a pregnant woman who's been declared brain dead has been kept on life support for over 3 months against the wishes of her distraught family, all because of the state's 6-week abortion ban. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Gaza's humanitarian catastrophe is deepened following a weekend of Israeli attacks that killed scores of Palestinian civilians, including children, in just one of the attacks. An Israeli strike on a school-turned-shelter in Gaza City killed 36 people as they slept. Dozens of others were wounded, many with burns. Video of the aftermath shows the silhouette of a 7-year-old girl rushing to escape the flames. Her mother and siblings were killed in the attack, survivors described a horrific scene.
An indescribable sight. Body parts, charred people, the smell of sulfur, the smell of charring. I swear to God, our hearts have died. This is how we are shaken. Our nerves are damaged. We're exhausted. We're tired. By God, we're tired. Enough.
Separately, Dr. Ala Al-Najjar, a pediatrician at Nasser Medical Complex in southern Gaza, saw 9 of her 10 children killed or buried under the rubble of her family's home in an Israeli airstrike. Only one of her children survived. 11-year-old Adam was left hospitalized, along with Dr. Al-Najjar's husband, who's also a doctor. We'll have more on this story after headlines with a British doctor who treated her only surviving son. On Monday, a nonprofit group backed by Israel and the United States began distributing limited amounts of aid in Gaza, despite objections from the United Nations, which says the mission could force the further displacement of Palestinians and likely violates international humanitarian law. Other aid agencies, including Mercy Corps and Save the Children, have distanced themselves from the NGO known as the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. It began operations just hours after its executive director, Jake Wood, announced his resignation. Wood wrote a statement calling for Israel to allow more aid into Gaza, adding, quote, "It's clear it's not possible to implement this plan while also strictly adhering to the humanitarian principles of humanity, neutrality, impartiality, and independence, which I will not abandon," he said. On Sunday, Israel's military announced it plans to capture 75%, that's three quarters of the Gaza Strip within 2 months, and to force Palestinian civilians into just a quarter of the Gaza's territory. The announcement came as U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem visited Jerusalem and toured Gaza's border with members of Israel's army. Thousands of young Israeli nationalists marched through occupied East Jerusalem Monday, chanting death to Arabs and may your village burn, as they attacked Palestinian businesses and harassed journalists and activists as part of their annual Jerusalem Day flag march. They also stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Earlier in the day, Israel's far-right national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, joined the protesters. Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported chants this year also included direct references to Gaza, such as, quote, there's no school in Gaza, there's no children left, unquote, and flatten Gaza. Opposition leader Yair Lapid said on social media, quote, the festival of hatred and racism in which Jewish teenagers are attacking Arab neighborhoods has become a tradition on Jerusalem Day in the Old City. It is a disgrace and an insult to Judaism, the Israeli leader said. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have been carrying out large-scale raids across the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Ministry of Health says Israeli troops shot and killed a 32-year-old Palestinian in Nablus, while the Red Crescent reports 19 people were wounded, including a 15-year-old boy, when Israeli forces opened fire with tear gas and live bullets. Russia fired a massive wave of drones and missiles at Ukraine overnight, killing at least six people. This follows a weekend of deadly Russian attacks that killed at least 14 civilians. Children were among the dead, including three siblings killed in a Russian strike on a home in northwestern Ukraine. Both parents were hospitalized, their mother with severe injuries. In Kyiv, at least eight people were injured when falling debris from intercepted drones crashed into neighborhoods. This resident survived a fire triggered by the attacks.
Putin doesn't want to end the war. I wish they'd agree to a ceasefire. To bomb people like this, poor children. My three-year-old granddaughter was screaming from terror. Of course, I wish for the Russians to accept the ceasefire, but Putin doesn't want it. I hope he dies.
Russia's wave of attacks followed hundreds of Ukrainian drone strikes over several days on targets inside Russia, including the capital, Moscow. Meanwhile, Russia and Ukraine completed a deal Sunday to exchange 1,000 prisoners each. It was the largest prisoner swap since Russia invaded Ukraine over 3 years ago. Here in the U.S., President Trump used his social media platform to criticize Russian leader Vladimir Putin, writing he had gone absolutely crazy. Reporters later asked him about the comments.
I don't know what the hell happened to Putin. I've known him a long time, always gotten along with him, but he's sending rockets into cities and killing people, and I don't like it at all.
Trump also lashed out at Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky for criticizing the White House after a pullback U.S. support for Ukraine. Trump wrote Zelensky, quote, is doing his country no favors by talking the way he does. Everything out of his mouth causes problems. I don't like it. It better stop, Trump said. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz said Germany and its allies will no longer impose limits on long-range weapons supplied to Ukraine. Immigration rights advocates around the U.S. are raising alarm over the Trump administration's arrest of dozens of people, including families with children, at U.S. immigration courts nationwide. Reports have emerged of federal immigration agents ambushing and detaining people at federal buildings in cities including Phoenix, Arizona, Miami, Seattle, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and across Northern California and Texas. Trump policies now allow ICE agents to make arrests of public schools, hospitals, places of worship, and other sites that were once off limits. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts temporarily halted a lower court order directing Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency to turn over documents as part of a Freedom of Information Act request. The Justice Department argued DOGE is not a federal agency and therefore cannot be subject to the FOIA request, which came from the accountability group, CREW, that's Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. This comes as Musk says he's returned to working 24/7 on his companies after wreaking havoc in the federal government for the past 4 months. Musk also announced last week he'll do a lot less political spending going forward. The Trump administration told a federal judge Friday it had reached an agreement with Boeing to drop criminal prosecutions over the fatal crashes of two 737 MAX jets in 2018 and 19, which killed together 346 people. Under the deal, Boeing would pay $1.1 billion in fines and investments, including to a crash victims fund. A lawyer for the families promised to urge a judge to reject the deal, saying in a statement, quote, this kind of non-prosecution deal is unprecedented and obviously wrong for the deadliest corporate crime in U.S. history, unquote. Here in New York, students from CUNY Graduate Center, Brooklyn College, and Baruch College are launching an indefinite hunger strike today to protest, quote, the Israeli-U.S. war machine that continues to starve Palestinians in Gaza to death and rain bombs down upon them, unquote. On the West Coast, Stanford University hunger strikers are entering their third week, and University of Oregon students, faculty, and staff have entered the second week of their fast for Gaza. U of Oregon hunger strikers spoke from the steps of the federal courthouse in Eugene.
The students, faculty, and staff participating in this hunger strike have one primary goal, and that goal is that all who bear witness to the hunger strike that we're participating in also bear witness to the humanity of Palestinians who are being starved to death en masse in Gaza, and to take every action possible to stop this crime against our shared humanity.
Students at Yale University ended their hunger strike Friday after 10 days amidst deteriorating health conditions among the activists. On Monday, President Trump threatened to cancel $3 billion in federal grants to Harvard unless the university hands over personal information about international students who make up more than a quarter of the student body. We'll have more on President Trump's escalating war on Harvard later in the broadcast. We'll speak with a history professor there. In Seattle, police deployed pepper spray and arrested at least 23 people Saturday after residents came out to protest a right-wing Christian event that locals dubbed Fascist Family Values. The far-right religious group has been on tour throughout the U.S. spreading transphobic and anti-LGBTQ messages through their mass public prayer events. Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell condemned the fundamentalist rally, which he said was, quote, inherently opposed to our city's values and the heart of Seattle's most prominent LGBTQ plus neighborhood, unquote. Venezuela's ruling party has claimed victory in regional and parliamentary elections that were boycotted by the opposition. Sunday's controversial elections were seen as another victory for President Nicolas Maduro's government, which claimed that for the first time it will have representation in the disputed region of Essequibo, which is administered by the neighboring country of Guyana and is internationally recognized as Guyanese territory. Maduro has recently intensified Venezuela's assertion over the oil-rich region and said on Sunday local voters had elected the first-ever governor of Venezuela's newly created state, Guyana Essequiba. Guyana's president has denounced this as a threat. This comes as the Miami Herald reports the Trump administration's quietly negotiating a high-stakes deal with Maduro to allow Chevron to continue exporting Venezuelan oil to the U.S. in exchange for Venezuela to begin accepting deported Venezuelan immigrants. And the world-renowned Brazilian photographer Sebastião Salgado died Friday in Paris. He was 81 years old. Salgado won global praise for his striking black-and-white photographs depicting the environment and the plight of workers and refugees around the world. He spent decades documenting the Amazon rainforest and indigenous communities in the region. One of his most celebrated series, taken in 1986, depicted the grueling labor conditions faced by gold mine workers in Brazil. Salgado also went on to document famine in Ethiopia, as well as President Reagan's failed assassination attempt in 1981. Salgado also co-founded the environmental organization Instituto Terra, Institute of the Earth, with his wife. In 2000, I spoke to Sebastião Salgado during an event in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
You have a responsibility to tell the people what is going on. And you must show, you must provoke a debate, you must provoke a discussion, because there is so many injustice. There is so many problems of distribution of health. There is so many problems of security. There is so many injustice around that you must show this. And that become a way of life.
Sebastián Salgado is survived by his wife, two sons, and two grandchildren. His family said his cause of death was leukemia. To see our interviews over the years with Sebastián, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show in Gaza. On Friday, an Israeli airstrike hit the home of a Palestinian pediatrician, killing 9 of her 10 children. The children ranged in age from 7 months to 12 years old. Dr. Ala Al-Najjar was working in the emergency room at Nasser Medical Complex at the time of the attack on her home. Her husband, Hamdi, who's also a doctor, was seriously wounded in the strike, is now being treated at Nasser. Their 11-year-old son, Adam, survived, but was also severely wounded. By the time Dr. Ala arrived at her home, emergency workers were pulling the charred bodies of her children out of the rubble. This is her brother-in-law, the uncle of her children, Ali Al-Najjar, who also rushed to the scene.
We searched through the rubble, calling from Yahya to Adam, "Answer us. Uncle, is anyone there?" Not a single person beside us. Right next to us, my cousin rented 3 shops, or maybe 2, tire repair shops. The fire had spread to the tires, and civil defense extended the hose to extinguish the flames because the hose was at risk of collapsing from the fire. One of the shops was full of rubber tires. As we were trying to put out the fire, we were shocked to find the first charred body. They quickly continued, extinguishing the fire, and we started pulling out charred bodies. One of the civil defense workers was handing me one of the bodies. She, who was standing next to me, recognized it. She said, "This is Rivel. Give her to me." Look at her instinct as a mother, as if her daughter were still alive. She asked to hold her in her arms. She's a pediatrician. See the subconscious reaction? She wanted to embrace her daughter, forgetting that her daughter was burned in front of her eyes. We took those charred children and transferred them to Al-Nasser Hospital. I took the doctor with me. She is now caught between the dead, her only surviving child, and her husband, who is between life and death. May God grant her patience and grant us patience, too.
UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese condemned the attack on the Al-Najjar family, describing Israel's targeting of families as a, quote, distinguishable, sadistic pattern of the new phase of the genocide, unquote. We go now to Gaza, where we're joined by Dr. Graham Groom, an orthopedic surgeon with the NHS. That's the National Health Service in London. He's volunteering with the charity Ideals at the Nasser Hospital in Gaza, where he treated Dr. Ala Al-Najjar's sole surviving child, 11-year-old Adam. We thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Groom. Can you describe the horror? What happened to the doctor's family?
Well, it's difficult for me to describe the horror of what happened to his, to her family, because we were in the operating theatre all day, and this little scrap of humanity arrived when we should have finished what we had planned to do, and poor Adam was sent up to us, so for us to remove his left arm. I think we can imagine what it, or perhaps we can't imagine what it's like for poor Dr. Ala to go to work in the morning, but when she goes to bed at night, if she goes to bed at night, she has only 2 living members of her family. The rest are dead, and the 2 living ones are gravely injured and maybe permanently damaged. What we do in theatre in this ghastly situation is that his little body is covered from top to toe in penetrating injuries. He is literally peppered. And of course, the explosion is makes him filthy. So the first thing is to clean him from top to toe and then look for other injuries. Now, the arm injury was bad enough. He also had a wrist injury on the same side. But the the thing that made us worry about him is that he was bleeding from both ears, which means he may have had a fracture at the base of his skull, a laceration on his skull. He was unconscious. And so that a head injury would be a more significant and possibly permanent issue than his arm injury. But what we do with that is we clean it. We stabilize the bone, and we remove the dead and devitalized tissue. And I'm pleased to say that this poor little boy, as he's not covered, that would not be a sensible word to use, but he is improving. So when I saw him the following day, he was eating breakfast with his right hand. When we could have a look at him properly, it was clear that he had a cranial nerve injury, so that one of the muscles to his right eye wasn't working properly. When he tried to look to the right, it was as though he had a lazy eye. Now, fortunately, we've got an ophthalmologist here, and that is improving. But the significance of that is that people who are very, very close to explosions have what we call a traumatic brain injury. Their brains are scrambled, and their cognitive function may be permanently damaged. We will continue to work on his arm and his other injuries. Time will tell about his brain injury.
And Dr. Groom, many people have speculated the enormous number of medical personnel who've been killed by the Israelis, that they are targeting medical workers. What is your sense of, among the medical community that works there, your view of what the Israelis are doing to these folks who are seeking to save lives?
We've heard that a lot. We've been coming to Gaza with our little charity for 16 years, and we've done a lot of training, so we know many of the doctors in my line in orthopedic surgery. We've had seven fellows come to train with us in London, three surgeons, two nurses, two physiotherapists. The first of our fellows, in the context of targeting doctors, was arrested before Christmas 2023, and died in an Israeli prison on the 19th of April 2024. So we have a personal involvement in this view that medical workers are being targeted. Another of our very close colleagues is a superb surgeon, excellent man, is in an Israeli prison. Nothing has been heard of him for many, many months, and we are all very fearful that he will suffer the same fate.
And the Israeli the Israeli military has reissued a wide evacuation warning for all of Rafah and Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip. That's where you are now. What are you seeing in terms of this this major ground offensive of the Israelis?
Well, earlier on, before this evacuation order, we were seeing a great increase in casualties, but we're not now because there's no access to NASA. The evacuation line has swept past us, but we've not been ordered to evacuate, so we are a little island in the midst of the red zone. We will wait and see.
Dr. Graham Groom, I wanted to ask you about another doctor. In 2024, the prominent Palestinian orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Adnan Al-Dosh, was killed by torture after being detained by Israeli forces for over 4 months at the Ofer prison in the occupied West Bank. He was head of orthopedics at Al-Shifa Hospital, but was arrested by Israeli soldiers when he was temporarily providing care at Al-Awda Hospital in Jabalia in the north of Gaza. Dr. Groom, Dr. Adnan Alberch was a fellow in your training program for limb reconstruction. Was that in London? And can you tell us more about him?
Well, he was, yes, it was. I didn't name him because it may be a distraction, but yes, he was a lovely fellow. He came to us, not within our limb reconstruction training program, not within the British one, but as an additional fellowship, which was funded separately. He was with us for 6 months. He was a delightful fellow. He was extremely enthusiastic. He sat at our table. He loved every moment of his time in London, and we loved him because he was such an affable, lovely fellow. And we grieve for his family and his six children now that he's gone.
And Dr. Groom, you work with the National Health Service in London, typically, and last week the United Kingdom suspended trade talks with Israel and said it will impose sanctions on West Bank illegal settlers. The British Prime Minister Keir Starmer called Israel's announcement that it would allow a small quantity of food into Gaza as totally and utterly inadequate. What more would you like to see the world do right now about the situation in Gaza?
I would want firm pressure to stop the slaughter of the innocents. Only a tiny proportion of the people killed have any relation to Hamas. There is a mighty military machine that is seeking to defeat a nimble and elusive foe. And between them, there's this huge number of civilians who are totally uninvolved, but they are the ones who are being attacked. They're the ones who are being killed. They are defenseless and almost entirely blameless. And I would like the world to say, stop.
And finally, I wanted to ask you about this latest news of this nonprofit backed by Israel and the U.S., which began distributing this limited amount of aid in Gaza, despite objections from the U.N., which says the mission could force the further displacement of Palestinians and likely violates international humanitarian law. Groups like Mercy Corps, Save the Children, have distanced themselves from it. It's called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. It began operations just hours after its executive director, approved by Israel and the U.S., Jake Wood, resigned. He wrote in a statement calling for Israel to allow more aid into Gaza, adding, "It's clear it's not possible to implement this plan while also strictly adhering to the humanitarian principles of humanity, neutrality, impartiality, and independence, which I will not abandon," he said as he resigned. If you can talk about what that means as you treat people when people are starving, I mean, even people who are starving, who are burned, the inability to graft skin onto them because their skin won't tolerate it.
I think those are two separate issues. I must say, I read his statement. I'm full of admiration for him. I entirely support his position. I think it is impossible to be consistent with the principles of international humanitarian aid in the context of this new organization. And of course, it's unnecessary. There is another agenda, but we're moving from the humanitarian into the political. And I'm not a politician, I'm a doctor.
Well, I thank you so much for being there. You're also, to say the least, extremely brave. Dr. Graham Groom, orthopedic surgeon with the NHS, the National Health Service in London, volunteering with the charity Ideals at the Nasser Hospital in Gaza in Khan Yunis, where he treated Dr. Ala Al-Najjar's sole surviving child, 11-year-old Adam. Dr. Ala Al-Najjar's other nine children were just killed in Israeli airstrike on her home. Her husband had just taken her to work. He, too, is a doctor. He arrived home and the blast took place. He, too, is in intensive care. Coming up, we look at President Trump's escalating war on Harvard University as he attempts to block almost a third of the student body, the international students, from attending the school. Stay with us. Malian singer Khaira Arbi in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to President Trump's escalating war on Harvard University and academia as a whole. On Friday, a federal judge temporarily blocked a move by the Trump administration to bar Harvard from enrolling international students. They make up well over a quarter of Harvard's student body. A hearing on the case will be held today. On Monday, Trump threatened to redirect $3 billion in federal grants from Harvard to trade schools. CNN is reporting trade schools. CNN is reporting the Trump administration is also poised to cancel $100 million in federal contracts with Harvard University. On Monday, Trump slammed Harvard for accepting so many international students and for not handing over detailed personal information about them.
Part of the problem with Harvard is that there are about 31%, almost 31% of foreigners coming to Harvard. We give them billions of dollars, which is ridiculous. We have Americans that want to go there and to other places, and they can't go there because you have 31% foreign. Now, no foreign government contributes money to Harvard. We do. So why are they doing so many? Number one. Number two, we want a list of those foreign students, and we'll find out whether or not they're okay. Many will be okay, I assume. And I assume with Harvard, many will be bad. And then the other thing is they're very anti-Semitic.
President Trump's escalating his threats as Harvard resists requests by the federal government to hand over detailed personal information about its international students. On Monday, Trump wrote on Truth Social, the information is needed to determine, quote, how many radicalized lunatics, troublemakers all, should not be let back into our country, unquote. On Monday, Democracy Now! Reached Francesco Anselmetti, a British-Italian international graduate student in Harvard's joint PhD program in History and Middle East Studies. He's a member of Harvard's Graduate Student Union. He responded to Trump's threats.
Trump's revocation of Harvard's ability to enroll and register international students is, of course, it's an attack on Harvard's international community. It's also seemingly one of the largest, perhaps the largest, threat of mass deportation on a unionized workforce in American history. I mean, this is an attack on American academia, as it is an attack on American labor. Around 25% of the university's community, including around 4,000 workers, many of whom do the bulk of teaching at Harvard, many of whom, you know, despite a federal judge blocking the Trump administration's action, are left in a position of extreme precarity and uncertainty over the short and medium term future. We expect you know, the Harvard, we expect the Harvard to continue fighting for its international students in the courts. But we expect them to do so also in part because it's in their interest, right? What we aren't so sure about is whether it is in their interest to truly stand up for the free speech and intellectual autonomy it claims to be defending. In order for it to do so, it would have to seriously consider the claims of various student groups that have been operating on campus over the last 2 years in solidarity with Palestinian rights, groups which Harvard has had really no trouble in disciplining, in some cases banning. And the irony here is that, of course, these decisions from Harvard have represent caving to outside pressures, right? These, in many cases, have been decisions that Harvard has been pressured to do in response to right-wing groups, in response to donors who represent, you know, interests that are that want to eradicate any pro-Palestine sentiment on American university campuses.
That was Harvard graduate student Francesco Ansamete speaking to Democracy Now! Harvard's UAW unions have condemned the Trump administration attacks on graduate student workers. We're joined now by Alison Frank Johnson, a professor of history at Harvard University, the chair of the German department. She's also a member of the American Association of University Professors, the AAUP. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Professor. If you can start off by talking about what Trump is demanding, what exactly this means as students who are in Cambridge and are around the world, not knowing whether they are being forced to leave as we speak.
That's right. This is these measures are targeting not only the students who haven't arrived yet, who've been admitted but are still at home packing, planning to go to college, to start their doctoral programs, but also students that are well into programs they've already started. Some of them supposed to graduate on Thursday, the day after tomorrow. Some of them 6 years into a 7-year PhD program. Some of them freshmen and sophomores at college. Even before these latest measures targeting international students, F1 and J1 visa holders were announced, we had already seen the harassment of international students and scholars coming into the United States. I know many international students who were afraid to go and do research, to go to archives, to go accept collaborative grant offers from other universities, which actually do and many times fund research that is being done at Harvard, afraid to leave the country because they didn't know if they'd be let back in even before this was happening. So this is a massive escalation, but it's not the beginning of the attacks on the embeddedness of the research that we do in a global community.
And Professor, we had a segment last week about talking about how the European Union, Canada, the UK, even Australia have been increasing the amount of money that they're devoting to scientific research, hoping to lure Americans who are now being targeted by this war on science of the Trump administration. Could you talk the discussions you've been having with your colleagues about whether some of them are considering leaving, going to other countries, and what the long-term impact on America's lead in science and technology and research would be as a result of this?
Absolutely. So I'm a historian of modern European history. Three scholars in my field who work at Yale recently very publicly announced that they were leaving for Canada. So far, my colleagues at Harvard and I are trying to prevent that from happening. So our focus right now is to try to work together to ensure that Harvard continues to be a place where people will want to and be able to do cutting edge research. And so we are not yet planning for this mass exodus, but we're aware that that is one potential outcome, one we very much want to avoid. The work being done at Harvard, where grants have been cut, in fact, I think today the Trump administration announced they were cutting all contracts and all grants with Harvard University. That affects people working on tuberculosis, on ALS, on soft robotics, on diabetes, obviously on cancer, repairing eye damage, people working on doing things like translating the Dead Sea Scrolls. That work has already been done, reducing school absenteeism. This is useful research. It's useful to any country that will host it. And in fact, it's useful to the whole world, no matter where it takes place. So I do understand that there will be attempts to poach some of the best scholars that we have at the university. Although, as I said, my colleagues and I right now are trying to, that's not the outcome that we want. We don't want to see people get well-paying jobs and fellowship opportunities elsewhere. We want to save this university.
And could you talk about the range of demands that the Trump administration has made of Harvard in relation to these foreign students, what exactly they want, the information they want?
Well, for better or for worse, it's not entirely clear what they want. I think what they want is to destroy Harvard University as a way of destroying independent research and scholarship that they can't control, intimidating the other universities that they haven't yet targeted by destroying Harvard. So whatever Harvard does, it's not going to be sufficient. You heard from the graduate student that you already interviewed that the university has actually taken many of the steps that the Trump administration has requested and demanded, including dismissing the director of the Center for Middle East Studies, including providing lots of information about our international students and accepting a definition of anti-Semitism that the regime favors. They also provided all legally required information related to the visa program that is being canceled, SCVIP. They did that. So when the Trump administration says that they haven't provided the information that's required, it's not clear what exactly it is that Harvard even legally could provide that they still want. So Harvard does have an obligation to protect the privacy of its students, I think to a lesser extent of its employees, but certainly of its students. It can't just divulge anything to anyone. The federal government is the entity that has issued every single one of these students their visas. So presumably they already have access to the names and countries of origin of all of the students whose visas they have approved. I think that whatever their demands are, and they certainly extend beyond what the law requires, even if Harvard were to meet them, they would come up with a new set of demands that it hadn't met. It's very clear that what they want to do is run the university into the ground.
Before we go, I wanted to ask you two quick questions. You talked about some of the grants and what would be shut down. What about the grants around scientific research? I mean, you have the situation where the Harvard School of Public Health, apparently, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that they are cutting funding for the School of Public Health, laying off people, also reducing graduate student admissions. What about other schools? And also Trump's comments when he says, we're still waiting for the foreign student list from Harvard, as you point out. They already have the list because they give them the visas. They know who's there, unless they want much more personal information. But Trump says, so that we can determine after a ridiculous expenditure of billions of dollars how many radicalized lunatics, troublemakers all should not be let back into our country. What this means, not only for your school, but for the universities around the country.
Yes, I think that Harvard is being made of an example of, but Harvard is not really the target here. It's the independent scholarship that's being produced by universities. Universities that work also to solve medical problems that aren't very profitable, universities that are answerable to the truth and to future generations rather than to shareholders. And those universities do things like work on cures for cancer and work on cures for tuberculosis and work on cures for diabetes. And that work is obviously it's obviously essential. But we also do things like talk about climate change. right? We also do things like talk about the impact of income inequality. We also do things like talk about the importance of recognizing people's identities, their sexual and gender-based identities for their own mental health. We also talk about things like the segment that you aired before about what's happening right now in Gaza. And those messages, whether it's that vaccines work or that there is human-caused climate change or that we need to attend to the terrible tragedy that's occurring in the Middle East, are messages that the administration doesn't like, right? Universities, not only Harvard, do this work because they care about the truth. They don't just care about what's politically expedient for the current administration. And I think that the assertion that the administration should decide which students are allowed to come to Harvard, which scholars are allowed to come to Harvard, whose ideas are dangerous to whom, right? Dangerous to an administration that isn't interested in admitting that vaccines work, that isn't interested in admitting that there's climate change, that we should be reducing our dependency on fossil fuels. Dangerous to an administration whose foreign policy seems to run on friendships with bullies. That's the kind of control that they want to have, and Harvard can't let them have it because we won't be the last one they try to get it from.
Alison Frank Johnson, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll follow what happens with the hearing today and beyond, not only at Harvard, but at schools all over the country right now. Professor of History at Harvard University, chair of the German department, speaking to us from Munich, Germany. She's also a member of the American Association of University Professors. Up next, we go to Georgia, where a pregnant woman who's been declared brain dead has been kept on life support for over 3 months against the wishes of her family because of Georgia's six-week abortion ban. Back in 30 seconds.
They're marching down the street. Yeah. I see somebody marching. They're marching down the street. Oh, yes, they are. This time we stop and pray. We pray, oh Lord, to have a better day. Yeah. I see somebody marching. Marching down the street. Oh, yes, they are.
Crying in the Streets, performed by Zeeshan B in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Georgia, where there's growing concern about the plight of a pregnant woman who's been declared brain dead but has been kept on life support for 3 months against the wishes of her distraught family because of Georgia's abortion ban. Adriana Smith is a 30-year-old mother and nurse who suffered a medical emergency in February due to blood clots in the brain, was declared legally dead. At that point, she was about 9 weeks pregnant. She's now about 22 weeks pregnant, but doctors have kept her on breathing machines because her fetus was old enough to have detectable cardiac activity. Georgia's heartbeat law bans abortions after a fetal heartbeat is detected. This comes as Georgia's attorney general said Georgia's heartbeat bill does not require medical professionals to keep a woman on life support after brain death and issued a terse statement that, quote, removing life support is not an action with the purpose to terminate a pregnancy. Georgia's maternal and infant mortality rates are among the worst in the country, with black women dying at twice the rate of white women. We're joined now by two guests. In Washington, D.C., Minnie Timiraju is with us, president of Reproductive Freedom for All, formerly NARAL Pro-Choice America. And in Atlanta, we're joined by Monica Simpson, executive director of Sister Song, the National Woman of Color Reproductive Justice Collective that's based in Georgia, has a lawsuit against Georgia, arguing its six-week abortion bans denying people in Georgia life-saving care. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Monica Simpson, let's begin with you. Can you talk about this situation right now, what the family wants for their beloved brain-dead loved one who is pregnant and who doctors are keeping on life support?
Thank you so much for having me. It is a dire situation that we're dealing with here in Georgia, and we are constantly having to navigate this system that keeps showing us over and over again that it is deadly to be Black and pregnant in this state where access to care is so far out of reach for so many people, and the limitations and the criminalization that we are constantly navigating now with this abortion ban is something that Georgians did not want, and it's something that we are constantly doing all that we can to push back against. Adriana deserved to be here. What we know about her story is that she did what she knew what to do as a nurse. When she found out and she could feel in her own body that something was wrong, she went to the doctor. She went to get the care that she needed, and she was sent home. Now, if the doctors would have did everything they could, maybe we would have been able to get a different outcome for Adriana. But unfortunately, that's not what happened, because unfortunately, that's not what happens for so many Black women in this country. They are not trusted when they are going into their doctor's offices. They're not trusted when they are saying that there's something wrong with their bodies. They're not trusted when they are saying that they need access to care. And unfortunately, that's what happened to Adriana. And so now her family is battling such a hard time. They should be able to grieve. They should be able to take care of themselves and all of the family members who are having to deal with this ordeal. But unfortunately, they're having to navigate so many unanswered questions. They're having to navigate something they shouldn't have to, which is an abortion ban that's connected to this issue that should not even be at play at this particular moment.
And in Georgia, we're talking about one of the states that has among the worst maternal and infant mortality rates in the country, particularly for African-American women and children. Could you talk about that?
Absolutely. We are dealing in Georgia with maternal health deserts, right? Over half of our counties do not have access to an OBGYN. So care is out of reach for so many. We are also a state that is yet to expand Medicaid. And we know federally, we are still fighting for Medicaid to be something that Americans have access to, which means that there are thousands of people upon thousands of people who are falling in the cracks every single day, not having access to basic health care needs. So when you add that to a state that has now put a 6-week abortion ban in place, it makes it a very, very harsh environment for folks to be able to get access to what they need in terms of their reproductive health care.
I mean, it is amazing. Georgia's Attorney General, Chris Carr, released a statement declaring that the 6-week abortion ban doesn't require medical professionals to keep women alive on life support after they've been declared brain dead. Monica.
What I find very interesting about the times that we are in is that this abortion ban has created so many obstacles for people. There has been too many people who have tried to figure out what it means, when it means that. And that is the problem that we're dealing with here. It is not cut and dry. It is not black and white. It is something that we're having to constantly navigate over and over again. At the end of last year, we lost 2 more Black women because of what this abortion ban put in place for them in terms of a barrier. We lost Amber Nicole Thurman and Candy Miller, right? These are 2 Black women who were also pregnant in our state that wanted to terminate a pregnancy and came up against the very real barriers that this abortion ban puts in place for folks. And so what is happening constantly as we are getting these stories, as we're understanding what the landscape is really looking like for people in Georgia because this abortion ban is in place, is that it is not a cut and dry. And we're not getting cut and dry answers here. We are dealing with folks who are in real time having to navigate too many questions whenever it should be that we should have access to the real time health care that we need in order for us to be able to thrive and to live our most healthy lives in Georgia. And that is not the case with this abortion ban that is currently in place.
I want to bring Mini Timaraju into this conversation and relate it to what's going on nationally. President Trump's so-called big, beautiful bill that many call just a tax break for billionaires squeaked by in the House, now is in the Senate for a vote on reconciliation bill that would defund hundreds of, among other abortion care clinics, Planned Parenthood clinics. A last-minute addition Thursday would ban Affordable Care Act health care plans from covering abortion. Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez slammed the bill Wednesday ahead of the vote. This is what she said.
I want people to understand, for my Republican colleagues who are sure what is in and not in this bill, in this process that has been this rushed, when you wake up in the morning, you will realize that you voted to defund Planned Parenthood and to take away health care from 13.7 million Americans. And when this country wakes up in the morning, There will be consequences to pay for this, and I yield back.
That's AOC. I want to bring in Mini Timaraju, president of Reproductive Freedom for All, formerly known as NARAL. You've launched a series of TV ads targeting key senators ahead of the vote on this budget bill. In light of what's happening now in Georgia, the six-week ban, give us the map of the country and what this budget bill means.
Thanks, Amy. And thank you, Monica, for her incredible work and her team, not just in Georgia, but across the country. You know, we've got 21 states with extreme abortion bans and restrictions. You layer on top of that, this is the post-Dobbs reality, right? The map. In these states like Georgia, by the way, I want to mention Brian Kemp and Chris Carr, they disbanded their statewide maternal health review commission, and they stopped issuing public reports. So you've got this perfect storm across the country of 21 states where they've banned abortion, they've already shut down critical health care systems and clinics, and they've already created this chaotic situation like we're seeing in Georgia and in my home state of Texas. Then you talk about gutting Medicaid and potentially defunding Planned Parenthood. That would also impact clinics in blue states. And this is really important because these blue states have been absorbing the patients. These are states that have Democratic majorities, super majorities, Democratic governors and AGs, where they've been boosting up and plussing up, stockpiling mifepristone, medication abortion, telemedicine services, clinic infrastructure in the states. But they would be gutted as well. Many of them receive Medicaid, or they fall under the provision that you mentioned that would disconnect abortion care from Medicaid and Medicaid services. So we're talking about completely dismantling family planning and abortion care services nationwide at a time where we know we already have a maternal health crisis that particularly impacts women of color. But we also have clinics across the country being attacked and patients who need that critical care trying to travel from states with bans to other states, particularly the blue states. So we are literally walking ourselves into Congress is literally walking us into a crisis of forced birth when we have Medicaid services that cover the majority in many parts of this country of births, prenatal care, and postpartum care. And it's unconscionable, and it is deliberate, and it is by design.
And Mini Timaraju, what specifically in this so-called big, beautiful bill in terms of the cuts will affect it, especially when it comes to Medicaid, the poorest of our citizens?
I mean, look, the bill that came out of the House decimates Medicaid. It cuts significant funding to provide tax breaks for billionaires. There's a couple of things that are going to immediately happen. You're going to see clinics, hundreds. Planned Parenthood estimates 200 of their clinics that provide not just abortion care, but also general family planning services. That's prenatal care. That's postpartum care. That's cancer screenings. That's STI screenings. That's well woman visits. In many places, it's general primary health care. And the safety net for healthcare for many Americans, not just women, but all families. They're estimating 200 clinics to close nationwide should this bill go down, should this bill pass the Senate. In addition, you've got hospital systems lobbying against this bill. You've got insurance providers lobbying against this bill because this bill would also just decimate healthcare infrastructure well beyond family planning services. When that happens, the poorest of Americans who need these services, but also a lot of Americans who are getting these services who might not realize when they go to Planned Parenthood and they get the subsidized care, it's actually Medicaid, are going to be forced into our nation's ERs. They're going to be forced into other clinics. They may not get care at all. And that will have a dramatic impact on all Americans, regardless of where you get their health care, because it will decimate the larger health care system.
We only have 20 seconds. How are you fighting back?
We are lobbying aggressively the U.S. Senate. We are, as you know, we've launched these ads. We are organizing on the ground. We're working with partners like Monica and her team in Georgia. And we will be making sure Americans in those states realize that come 2026, if they've decimated Medicaid, there will be hell to pay.
Mini Timaraju, president of Reproductive Freedom for All, and Monica Simpson, executive director of Sister Song. That does it for our show. We're hiring a senior headline news producer, a director of audience, and a director of technology. To find out about all three jobs, go to democracynow.org/jobs. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!